Welcome, everyone, to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everybody. Here today to talk to you about the domestic and worldwide champion movie of the weekend. That would be Wonder Woman.
Indeed, Pete. Incredible box office, both in this country and abroad. It's funny how 2 weeks ago, the tracking, the anticipation was in the $65 to $75 million range. About a week and a half ago, it was maybe up to about $80. I think probably by the time the Thursday night preview numbers came in, it was clear it was going to be in the 90s. And the estimate right now, Wonder Woman having opened at $100.5 million in the United States, $122 million elsewhere, for a total of $223 million. An unquestionable hit, particularly at the relatively low budget of $149 million. This $100 million or so less than your Pirates is, or your, frankly, you know, most of the Marvel team up movies and so forth. So an unquestionable hit.
I have to wonder, given the hubbub in the last week about irresponsible and uninformed males freaking out over women-only screenings, the few that happened, how much they were helped by that as far as non-paid advertising.
Certainly a certainly I think a very, very fair observation there. And in this world we live in, sometimes there is such a thing as bad publicity, but I think that quote unquote bad publicity turned into good publicity indeed. Pete, as our prologue of sorts rolls along here, we're going to briefly and intelligently touch on a couple of PG-13 topics. So we know sometimes people are listening with wee ones, might want to hit pause. Again, we're not gonna take things past PG-13, but just want to give a little heads up in case you're driving with the kiddos or something.
Absolutely. I might have to cover my ears too.
Well, Pete, just as a prologue, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge some things about Wonder Woman creator William Moulton Marston. This is not a bit. This is all true. He was, of course, when he created the character in the 1940s, he was trying to agitate a new age of female empowerment. He was also into dominance and submission in like the 50 Shades kind of way, generally, but not necessarily along traditional gender lines. He was also into bondage as an aid to help one accept a submissive lifestyle. And Pete, he had a long-term polygamous relationship with his wife and a former graduate student. He had children with both of them. And the two gals, in fact, shared a home with him and kept the home after his death. I kind of find some of that whole picture to be somewhat contradictory to the ethos of Wonder Woman, but
just <a little. laughs>
whatever floats your whipcracking boat, as long as it's safe, as long as it's consensual, I guess you go with your bad self. William Moulton Marston, wife and mistress, or wife and other wife. So, yeah.
Well, we can be grateful for him for one thing, that he created this character.
He also, and I didn't put this in our notes, Pete, he also developed, perhaps with his wife or his first wife, developed the blood pressure monitor portion of the lie detector, of the polygraph.
He developed a lasso of truth of sorts as well?
He did, and depending on where you're checking your info, his legal wife, shall we say, his first wife, if you want to be a little more open to the poly, that's poly polygamy. Wait, not the polygraph,
polygamy. Wow,
Pete, it's all connected. Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who had a PhD in psychology. His wife had at least a master's or a PhD as well in psychology. His wife would go on to be the woman in the man's world, the breadwinner, particularly after his death in his 50s, while the other woman in their life was the stay-at-home mom. So a unique way to do it. And again, Pete, I'll just kind of conclude that particular note on, hey, if it works for you, have at it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he practiced in life things that run very, very contrary to the initial incarnation of his character, and definitely the wonderful one we see on our screens currently.
And Pete, as we wrap up the prologue here on a much more serious note, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the tragedy which hit the family of Justice League director Zack Snyder. In March, his adult daughter committed suicide, and that has led to Snyder and his wife, film producer Deborah Snyder, to step away from post-production work on Justice League. Some of their work may be discussed in today's podcast, but it's all a professional assessment, and of course, nothing personal as they deal with this this unimaginable tragedy in their family.
Yeah, we mentioned the news about the women only screenings of Wonder Woman, which created its own really lame brouhaha by Dude Bros. But shocking in the last week to 10 days, this announcement that the Snyder family had gone through this really unthinkable tragedy, and the news of it only just came out as Joss Whedon came in to kind of finish up and, you know, pinch hit with whatever further responsibilities still remain on Justice League. So the geek community, that I'll say that, of course, because we have that in our name, positively, has been really, really cool about this, and I would expect nothing less. Only somebody with, you know, some problems would give a guy whose family is going through this pronounced tragedy any kind of a hard time over the comic book movie that he's making and the ones he's made in the past. So, yeah, I mean, anything obviously we will bring up here, and he does have a partial writing credit to this film, would be in a professional sense, and not, of course, to pick on, you know, the tragedy that this poor family is going through.
Well, with prologue parts 1, 2, and 3 out of the way, let's now dive in, Pete. Let's talk our heroes of the film, of course, starting with Gal Gadot as Diana, a.k.a., I believe it's Wonder Woman?
Yes, it is the Wonder Woman, Diana Prince here. And we did Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice a year ago. I hated it. Matt liked it. Matt has moved more into the hate column since then. It would be beyond a backhanded compliment to say that this is the greatest DC extended universe movie put out to this date. It's far and away anything better than they've cranked out of the four. Don't know how much of that has to do with the fact that this is, you know, 99% a prequel to the Murderverse stuff that we've seen. But while she was something that people held on to in Batman v Superman as a positive, she crushes it here. She's a superstar now, and certainly looking forward. I just hope that wherever they are in the Justice League situation, they know to make appropriate and ample use of her. And, you know, Matt mentioned it yesterday on Twitter, and I'll do it here. They ran a Justice League trailer before this movie that, you know, kind of pushes Wonder Woman over to the side there. And, you know, all right, she gets a couple funnies in a movie that now has jokes when we've had a no jokes policy before. Yeah, I hope that changes.
I love the line that Gal Gadot walks as this wide-eyed neophyte in the first half of the movie while not appearing dumb. I think it's a credit to her. It's a credit to director Patty Jenkins, and it's a credit to Chris Pine, who we'll discuss more in depth in a little bit, where somehow this is divided up, where she can be seeing a largely familiar world. Yes, it's 100 years ago, but we understand how the world of Europe during World War One works. It's the, you know, it's not flying cars, it's not Green Lantern rings, it's our world with just slightly less technology. And the fact that she's able to enter it, not understanding the rules of it completely, but still come off strong the entire time, it really is a credit to her as an actress.
Absolutely. And I'm going to double down there and bring up the tremendous job that her child version played in helping to effortlessly lead to that non-dumb, naive, but strong portrayal. This little Lily Aspel, she's 8 years old, Matt, now, which means she was, what, 7 when they filmed this? She did a tremendous job, and you're pulled in there. We're going to talk a little bit about what bookends the film, which is clearly the weakest part of it. You got to wonder where the discussion was with the creators at some point, as far as, all right, you know, we're part of this larger universe and here's, you know, the handoff and everything like that. But I almost wish we had kind of taken that off and allowed it to begin on its own and breathe on its own. It's part of a larger universe, and that's kind of the homage you've got to go for. But every incarnation of this character glimpsed on screen in this film is tremendously done. And I think that speaks to the director in Patty Jenkins and everything that they were going for. Something she's had on her radar, Matt, since 2005.
And you mentioned Patty Jenkins, she of the employ of Marvel Films to direct Thor 2 for a whopping 2 months before there was Pete. The favorite phrase of any ending of a partnership in Hollywood, it's called creative differences. So I don't know where that is. I'm not saying the Thor 2 is a train wreck. I'm not saying that she would have made Thor 2 better. I have no problems with Thor 2. I don't know if creatively that's where she wasn't at. I don't know if it was a studio thing, a her thing, but I couldn't help but remember that this weekend that you know, she could have been on her second or third or fourth Marvel movie at this point. Who knows? She could have been in line for Avengers 4, or who knows? But
well, I mean, and who knows? I mean, we have not had a director cross those. I mean, you want to say Joss Whedon is now, as he's really kind of picking up for Zack Snyder at the end. And I think he will do everything to kind of forego credit other than what the Directors Guild mandates. And even then there might be some extenuating circumstances, but you know, full on credit to Patty Jenkins. She had a vision the entire time. I could have sworn there was a woman in the writing credits here, Matt. There is not. So I think we're going to give, you know, appropriate credit to Patty Jenkins as far as taking what the guys in Alan Heinberg and Zack Snyder and Jason Fuchs, along with Marston, as you mentioned before, you know, whipped up on the page. But I think this is a case where it really exceeds on screen what was written.
And to take away from none of that, let's now turn our attention to Chris Pine as Steve, not Rogers, Trevor. There's an incredible amount of exposition that is thrown his way. There's an incredible amount of, you must now play the audience. You know, we can't believe this place, or we can't believe that you don't understand how ice cream works and things of that sort. He has to carry the story at points. And I don't mean to take away from Gal Gadot at all, but there's times where narratively it's on him. Pete, he does a fantastic job playing second fiddle to her. Maybe that's this guy's future, especially with Star Trek kind of, you know, having uncertain film future. You know, maybe this guy is going to enter the next phase of his career as somebody who's enabling other actors and enabling scenes to happen, that sort of thing.
I mean, he is the male lead of this film. It's not his film, and he's led other films. You mentioned Star Trek. He was Jack Ryan. He's done some other stuff. But it's funny. I'm watching him, and I'm having a hard time, at least initially, not seeing Captain Kirk. And that's just my sensibilities, you know, coming from Star Trek. I thought he did a fine job. He did exactly what he needed to. He did not dare overshadow Godot's performance. I don't think you could. She's just got it down that well. I don't see him playing a second fiddle as a part in his career. I think we'll see him again in Star Trek, and I think he'll continue to get not A-League leading man roles, but you know, the plenty of the other stuff that's out there.
Well, next on the list of heroes here is Robin Wright as Antiope. That's also the Auntie, so that worked out well. I was going through, I'm like, what was her name? She's the Aunt. It's Antiope. Okay, Antiope, cool. That worked out well.
Do two negatives make a positive? You know, the antis. She did a great job. And again, you'd have to expect that from Robin Wright. Robin Wright, somebody who maybe a few years down the road, Matt, though her character died here with the direction that she's done on TV with House of Cards, that she could wind up directing a film like this.
I mean, certainly, if this movie is not a wellspring of female power, I don't know what could be. Added to that list, of course, is Connie Nielsen playing Queen Hippolyta, and another one of many statuesque ladies that are in this film.
Yeah, I dug the kind of distance she played the role with, as opposed to Antiope, who's embracing what Diana needs to be as far as this god killer. And the minute that came up, I'm like, oh, she's the god killer, Matt. I know there's been a little bit of discussion that it was predictable, but I think it was predictable in a positive sense that this is what it has to be. Of course, it's not going to be the sword or an arrow or anything as an item that's going to do away with Ares and bring that balance back or eliminate the prospect of war. It's this character. We have gods on the Marvel side. We have gods on the DC side in Superman and, you know, now with Wonder Woman. And I could have done with maybe a little bit more. And obviously, she's still in play, Connie Nielsen's character, Hippolyta, if they choose to return to Themyscira in the future. They've left it out there. Really kind of hoping that they do.
I mean, the notion that, of course, Diana herself is the god killer. Yes, perhaps it might be familiar territory. Heck, all the way back to The Wizard of Oz, if not before. You know, the power's always been inside you. But isn't that the point? That you have the power to enact these changes yourself? That you don't need some dumb sword that hangs in a really spectacular looking, but nonetheless hangs in some like dumb sword hanging sphere thing?
I like when it became part of her outfit. I thought that was really cool as well. It worked within it. You saw it. And you were like, yeah, that's her sword. But, you know, she had taken the dress in from the woman she took it from. And, you know, she doesn't need a dumb item. She doesn't need some dumb guy to do it. She does it all on her own. And I think that's, you know, part of the magic of this film.
Next on the list of heroes is Lucy Davis as Etta Candy, Steve's secretary. Pete, Let me throw an idea here to you, okay? Spin-off TV show. She could be the plucky British woman post-war, you know, kind of underappreciated by her male colleagues, but, you know, secretary by day, Agent Candy at night, something like that, fighting the Germans or something.
Is TV ready for it is my question.
We can only hope. We can only hope. Rounding out our heroes, Pete, we have Saeed Tagmaoui as Secret Agent Samir, Ewan Bremmer as Secret Agent Charlie, and Eugene Braverock as Secret Agent Chief.
We saw the picture of this cast, which is a plot point in Batman v Superman, more than a year ago. And to finally, it feels like forever, Matt, since we've, you know, seen that image and had to slog through the rest of that movie, made it feel even longer to finally get them on screen and have that picture taken in the little village in Belgium after Diana's gone over no man's land and they've saved these people. And yes, are there various similarities to Captain America, the first Avenger in this film? There are. Okay, can we get past that? There's a group of supporting soldiers who are very different from one another and draw from different heritages. I think that we can, and understand that each gave a piece to the story in a way that the ones in Captain America didn't. You know, we've got Sammy as the actor, as somebody who, as a person of color, draws a bond with Diana. We've got the Scotsman, who's a sniper but suffers from PTSD. And then we've got the Native American, who is wrestling with the legacy of what Steve's people as Americans had done to his, and reconciling at the same time against this great war to end all wars that they're all trying to come out on the positive side of.
I appreciated that the picture taking scene was at roughly the middle. I had just assumed, since there was first the reveal of the picture in Batman v Superman, that it was going to be, you know, oh, at the very end, and this is like the picture at the end, you know, of the main conflict of the Wonder Woman plot. The fact that they took that picture and it was like, oh, wait, we have more story. I kind of don't know where things are headed. That was a nice twist indeed. Pete, speaking of twists, let's talk some of our villains here. We have Danny Houston playing a villain, General Eric Ludendorff.
Yeah, and I'm going to say up front, that's been another slam on this movie, is they lack a great villain, which I fairly disagree with. But I'll say it how I can't take credit for it, how I've seen it online. This isn't a villain picture. This is a superhero picture, and the villains serve to develop Diana, what she goes through in trying to take out General Ludendorff leads to her development and realization as a character. So I really appreciated, though he chewed the scenery a little bit, and you know, there was the whole motif of him taking the performance enhancing gas and all that. He was what I think he needed to be, you know, not a Darth Vader-esque, not even a Grand Moff Tarkin, if you will, but kind of like, here's this Imperial German guy serving the Kaiser, and he did bad things to other German guys, so he's a really bad German guy.
Well, I have to say, walking into this movie with no knowledge of where it was headed, in fact, I think there's a most recent preview out there that I haven't seen, I totally bought hook, line, and sinker this notion that, I mean, he, as you said, Pete, he's a really, really bad German because he shot another German. As soon as he was getting the performance-enhancing gas, which, side note, I can't take credit for this, saw it online, somebody said, hey, maybe they'll tie that into a DC Extended Universe Bane thing in the future. Which I think is an interesting tangent, but I kind of totally bought it as, oh, and for the big showdown, he's going to get so, you know, he'll get superpowered, she's superpowered, they'll duke it out because it's a comic book movie. The notion that there was a secondary bad person in the form of Dr. Isabel Marou, Dr. Poison, I said, oh, well, this is a great addition, and I didn't see the Ares reveal coming until kind of maybe the beginning of the third act. So it was well.
I didn't want to spoiler Pete him, And, you know, listeners.
Oh, go ahead, Pete. Sorry.
Longtime listeners may remember a story where we went to see back in the other DC. Well, it's a standalone trilogy, Dark Knight Rises. And in the casting for that film, when they cast Marianne Cotillard, they cast her outright as Talia al Ghul. And then that was changed to whatever name she assumes, so she can stab Batman at the end of the movie and say, "I'm Talia al Ghul." I lean over to Matt as we're digging into that movie and say, "Oh, there's Talia al Ghul," which he did not know. the same was done with this movie. And Daniel Thewlis, and I waited till Matt had kind of put it together before just bringing that up in the context of watching the film. But that's what happens when you watch a movie with me.
Well, I will say, and I'll take either David Thewlis and or Patty Jenkins and or the editor, whose name is Martin Walsh. I'll take some combination of the three of them slightly to task here. When you had the very first scene with Sir Patrick Morgan, played by Thewlis, there was just something about how that was shot. There's a look he gives as Diana and Steve are in there. Of course, she's not welcome. Of course, Steve is interrupting slightly, but there's kind of a knowing meta look.
Look?
It turns out he's metahuman. I think it's meant to be the breadcrumb that afterwards on second viewing you go, see? And to me, it just caught me enough where I said, I want to keep an eye on this guy who's calling for appeasement at any cost, which sounds a lot like, I know we're in World War I in the movie, but sounds a lot like some of the pre-World War II British stuff we actually don't need to fight a war with Hitler. We can treaty our way out of this.
And it's the wolf in sheep's clothing, man. It works so well. It's the last guy you would expect to be Ares. And I'm seeing him in that scene, and I know he is playing Ares, and I'm like, okay, well, what's he up to? Is it, do I protest too much and they just do the opposite, stupid humans that they are? And the setup for his character was both smart and effective.
And having spoken, of course, about Danny Houston and David Thewlis, have to add Elena Anaya to it as the aforementioned Dr. Poison. She has a striking face and really interesting jawline and all of that I think served the what do you want to call it, the prosthetic that the character wears. Mm-hmm. That kind of served it really well. And I dug, too, that it sounded like a lot of the lines that she was giving were recorded on set. It sounded slightly kind of blocked a bit by the prosthetic, which I appreciated. She was totally clear, but I appreciated that there was this, I don't know, something with that mask there. There was such a weirdly evocative thing to it.
Yeah, it really, really worked for me. The pathos that she brings, the prosthetic, her appearance in the scene when they're at the gala and Steve's trying to work her over for information, and that this is a woman that wants to be seen as beautiful despite the fact that she works with weapons of mass destruction. And the really interesting design of the prosthetic, I gotta wonder how accurate to the age it might have been. It's got a comic aesthetic to it as well, which I really appreciated.
Pete, let's now take a look at some of the key plot points, key locations from the film. Pete, let's start with the tag scene, which, that's a phrase that refers to something that's at the end, but the novel thing that they do here, because gotta connect it to the DCEU, is to have the tag at the top where a thing comes from Bruce Wayne to have her look at the picture so she can say, and now let me think back back to Titanic when the sheets were still new. Flashback.
Let's shoehorn a male hero into this that has very little place. I have a problem with it. I think it's the worst part of the movie. I'm settled in. I'm ready to be told this story. I'm super excited to see Wonder Woman get her own due. And we've got to get a handoff from Bruce Wayne. I get it. They had formed this partnership in Batman v Superman that's going to see him assemble the Justice League later this year. But I don't think you needed it. I really don't. So like, does she work at the Louvre? Was she there undercover? I guess it's biggest reason for being, other than, hey, you're in the DC universe and we're going to show you Bruce Wayne's, logo. So, you know, that he's floating around out there, I think, is to set up chronology, that this has clearly happened after the events of Batman v Superman, but like, can't the viewer figure that out on their own?
I would have been much happier to lose this scene entirely, have it start in the past, and then have a legit tag scene, whether it's mid-credit, end credit, before the credits, whatever it is, to tie it back into the chronology.
I mean, as a writer, Matt, boom, and end of the movie, you know, get her into real time, have... We already know she's immortal, that she's lived this longer span than everybody else from the other film. How old is she? The pictures where she's not aged. But how about, you know, she picks up the phone and calls Bruce Wayne. Okay, Bruce, get them together.
And that's just it. And I don't want to overly tax this bookend with a gender reading, but here's just the thought experiment. I'm not saying I fully believe in what I'm about to say, but here's an interpretation. This whole moment or amount of time that she thinks back on her past, which is the flashback of the main plot of the story, it's initiated by a guy.
Yep.
You know, hey, would you like to think back about your past? Yes, I would. My life, blah, 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 from Themyscira to the end of World War I. Hey, thought over. Dear Bruce, thank you for inspiring me to think about myself. Again, it's not quite that extreme, but did no one have that discussion and go, do we need to have her flashback initiated by a guy, even if it does tie things together? Because guess what? It's already tied together. She showed up in the other movie.
As I leaned over and said to Matt, is she thinking this to him? Like, I get the construction. We've got to have something happen so she can remember this. But it's an artificial problem in that you have the need to put her in the modern day and then flash back to this. Well, how do we get her to flash back to it? Okay, we'll use the picture. Maybe you'll tell me about it sometime. I just think there was a smarter solution on the table someplace other than doing that. Because if we're going to talk about female agency and the strength that this character exudes and the smartness with which they portray her and which Godot brings her life, to predicate it on, here's a thing from a guy, hurts the overall.
And again, at what point does this become a product of the producers, of the studio mandating a connection? I even wondered, and I don't want to overly say, you know, we're coming from Marvel's corner and Marvel's always great, because the worst Marvel movie, in my opinion, Iron Man 2, is bogged down by it's all connected. It's all connected. Look, it's all connected here because Coulson's going there and it's this. And I would argue that whenever the Marvel movies push for inorganic connections, that's where things really get slowed down. It's, you know, conversely, when it's, man, a guy just out of the blue, the Black Panther just appeared. What's going on? Wow, that just upped the stakes in Civil War. Oh, it's also smoothly setting up a movie, so on and so forth. fine, be that as it may, but it's like you can't push it. And I think they were saying, a la the five-pronged trident. Let's just do the math there. The five-pronged trident Aquaman now has. It's like, well, if they're going to do one connection at the end, we're going to do two, one at the beginning, one at the end.
The quintet.
Indeed. But Pete, after we get that bookend started for us, we start on the lovely island of Themyscira. This is a location which is absolutely gorgeous to look at. Lush Mediterranean, bright sun. Pete, if you can imagine such a thing in the DCEU, there's sunshine there. There's bright colors, some of which are primary colors.
You had to wonder if it was in the same dark murderverse that we've been for three films. And I'm looking at the waterfalls, and I'm looking at the gorgeous classical architecture, and I'm saying to myself, why is it taking three movies to get here? And can we stay here? It was wonderful. It was evocative. It was classic. And what a tremendous setting.
I particularly liked how we see the German in the, I suppose he was a German sailor, as he's reaching through, there's kind of that, you kind of get the larger, the macro sense of the barrier and whatnot, but literally where he's at the one end of the boat and nobody else sees it, and he leans forward and it's beautiful, and he leans back. Really, really evocative way to just sell you on this somewhat crazy idea that this island could exist as a hidden place.
I think it's completely symbolic, Matt. He is in the DC murderverse, and he reaches into this wonderful thing on the other side, which he can just barely glimpse, and then pulls it back.
Well, and of course, coming with him is where the story heads next, the notion that there's a world war on, the world war, the war to end all wars. And I totally bought the iconography, the sets, the costumes, the whole aesthetic to really sell World War One Europe.
Yeah, I think that it was a super smart decision. And as soon as I had heard they were doing the prequel idea that they were going to tell this classical story, I think that was the way to go. They've kind of written themselves into a murder mother box that they will return to in Justice League with jokes. But this could be serious with the war to end all wars, Matt, yet somehow be less dark than the three movies that preceded it.
And despite being 100 years ago, to also be rather timely, this notion of, the war to end all wars, but we know it's not going to be the final war. Chemical attacks, chemical warfare, gas attacks, things of this sort that unfortunately are still part of the landscape of conflict today. I thought, insofar as they were not trying to necessarily make this a referendum on our modern 21st century world, there still was this wide-eyed optimism out of Steve to say, you know, we can end war with this. We can be the ones to enact this change for everyone, even though we know that wouldn't be the case.
Though he's not terribly developed as a character, we get the repeated mention of his father, the idea about the watch. And I think, again, it speaks to that level of optimism. We're talking about the early 20th century, all of these developments going on. And while there was this terrible war and they were up against terrible threats, and, you know, he's flying a flying machine, Matt, and there are chemical weapons and everything like that, there still has this undercurrent that so much is possible. And again, in the biggest helmed female superhero film of all time, I think that's entirely too perfect.
The story also moves directly to London. I kind of loved the reveal of all the you know, the coal fireplaces and whatnot, just making the sky so incredibly sooty. And he's proud of it being this modern city, which of course it was and it is. But particularly with discussion in the news recently about the environment and this and that, the other, to turn back the clock 100 years and go, hey, this is the way it is here. And knowing that, you know, fast forward a generation and some of the smog troubles during World War II and so on and so forth, it's like they don't get that they're doing all of this to themselves. They don't fully understand that, whether it's environmental, whether it's war, whatever it might be. And again, the movie doesn't need to hammer that or push it down our throats for it to be timely.
I'll do you one better in terms of the timeliness, Matt. Yesterday, London suffered the attack on London Bridge, and then nearby there were 7 people killed. 2 weeks ago, we had the attack in Manchester. As we're recording right now, they have the benefit happening in Manchester. And for London to represent this thriving city, Steve even says it's not for everybody. But for it to be this thriving metropolis, for Etta to show up and be pithy, for the discussion with the outfitting of Diana, you know, oh, is this lingerie armor? Everything like that. It's cute and ultimately leads to the formation of our very diverse team. The only thing that going to London, you know, took out of it for me was that apparently Diana fell asleep and suddenly they're in London, to which I told Matt, the Mediterranean and Europe is small.
There is the one line from Steve that's like, oh, we got a toe, but it clearly was hand of the writer, and all the movies do it. This isn't a slam properly to this writing point. You got to somehow get from the, you know, what I'm assuming is the southeast Mediterranean all the way out of the Mediterranean and to London. I get it. But this notion of, oh, we got a toe and we're here. Okay, fair enough. London, by the way, is also where we have the line between Diana and Etta involving that lingerie. Why would you want to keep your stomach in? And Etta replies something like, you know,
somebody who doesn't have a tummy wouldn't wear the armor, wouldn't need the armor. And it's an authentic moment. It's funny between two women. Something that doesn't happen nearly enough in these types of movies.
Yeah, it's body positive and it's able to go both ways, because clearly, you know, Gal Gadot is unusual in her body type, shall we say, perhaps unattainable for most. But it's kind of this be who you are and be comfortable with it. Pete, as the story moves on, we eventually end up in the front lines in Belgium, in no man's land, and this notion of frustration, which of course is part of the World War One true life story of having these trenches dug in and nothing really happens other than the occasional shooting back and forth, or the occasional, you know, they advance, they get pushed back, we advance, we get pushed back. And this futility here leading to, in the no man's land, Pete, it takes a woman to cross the line.
Again, go one further. It takes a woman encountering another woman to be empowered in front of all of these men to go across no man's land and be the catalyst for this change.
And I mean, that scene, definitely a wonderful one, where she's crossing there. While in Belgium, we also get some story time spent in the castle as well as the gas complex. I like, as they're heading into the party at the castle, where she's told to stay in the sidelines for what I think are legit kind of logistical military reasons, all of a sudden she's sizing up that that other woman, and it's not clear right away what's going on. And then all of a sudden she's kind of, you realize that she's sizing up the other woman for her clothing. And I like that they don't show clunk on the head.
Right.
And she's pulling the dress on. I like that it's, they just leave that out and let you figure it out between the one scene and then her fantastic reveal in the castle.
Yeah, and I think that's another way to praise the direction here, and who knows what was filmed and what was cut. I'm sure we'll get deleted scenes when it comes to video, but you show the restraint of not needing the trope of, dung, slide you over here, let's see, how do I wear this armor, and instead have her show up resplendent in that blue gown. Looks like something Zeus would have crafted for her.
In the castle, she is about to pull the sword out to take down General Ludendorff. Later on, as we get to the climactic battle here, she is finally able to run the sword through him. And Pete, this is one of many, many instances, not only of the sword being used, but in the entire movie where no one bleeds except for a little scratch after the fight, all the way back in Themyscira. Never is there a drop of blood on the sword. I assume it's a ratings thing, or they're trying to avoid an R, so there's just the edict, no blood. So there's no, so you don't need to worry about taking scenes out, that kind of thing. But I guess that's where we're at, Pete. 2017, swords don't cut anymore.
I think it's a reaction to the DC Murderverse, and they're just trying to go to the extreme opposite end. You know, I kid, but we don't necessarily need that to sell cost, to sell any idea of, you know, damage. When the sword is put through Ludendorff and it's spotless on the other side. Yeah. But it's also a magic sword, so maybe it dodges blood cells.
That works. That certainly works. It is, of course, in that scene where there's the reveal that Ares has been, in fact, in the story all along. We also have kind of the parallel instance going on of the plane with the poison in it. And Steve, once again, Pete, Steve getting ready to board the plane to make the noble sacrifice for humanity. And I don't know, which way do you want to hit it, Pete? You want to hit it with Steve? You want to hit it with Ares? How do we do it?
I just hope when they pull him out of the ice that he'll remember Diana.
Pete, you may be getting a little confused there.
Wait, they're going to have that dance, right? Oh, they already had their dance.
Pete, speaking of which, and this wasn't in the notes, let me tip my hat to the movie for taking the other dance that a couple might do, that in the boudoir. I like that whole scene. I like that. Best of all, they don't show montage of kissing in bed and whatnot. You kind of don't need it. We can assume it's an incredibly private and first moment for her. Also, at no point is Steve comes off as a bit of a rogue, but I buy his 1917 respect of gender places in terms of sexuality and things of that sort. I don't think he's out there, you know, out there in the boudoir a lot with ladies. The restraint that he shows, he's going to walk out, he's going to close the door, and he comes in, he is welcome to stay.
He's above average, though. We got to remember that. And I joked before about not being able to see Captain Kirk with him in this role. And I think it's the best parts of that we see, that, you know, in a 23rd century, that, you know, a swaggering captain of a ship who makes times with the ladies also can respect what women are. And I think the character's treatment of Diana as a person was what it needed to be for this film that I could take my niece to.
Yeah, and even, I guess, to go back even further, to refer back to that scene in which Steve is in his birthday suit earlier on in the much earlier on in the story, it's simultaneously naughty and not naughty. I mean, when she's not sure what that thing is, I mean, they're just talking about
a watch,
they're talking about the watch. If it's mistaken for something else, it's body parts that we all know exist. Body parts that you know, body parts, as you said, Pete, you could take your niece, I could take my daughter to see this movie. I would. It's a tad long, I think, for her right now. I look forward to seeing it on home video where we can pause and so on and so forth. But, you know, I mean, there are gender differences physically. Okay, they don't take it any more than that. And then to turn it to a joke of, oh, it's a watch, that's also story planting for later on in terms of the significance of the watch. But back to the final showdown, Pete, I thought with the exception of her temporarily damaged hearing, I thought this was kind of showdown that you get for most comic book type movies. I'm not going to take issue with the fact that it was merely okay. It's kind of what you do when you've spent two hours and 15 minutes setting up the world, the character's backstory, the character introduced to this world, the character, call to action, the baddie, why the baddie is bad. This is what you do in the last 10 minutes. You have a big showdown where they throw stuff at each other and whatnot.
I would have liked to have seen them push a little bit more past that. I was invested in both of the characters throwing down there. I think they're smart to intercut what the group is doing to get rid of the, magic chemical weapons that are going to, hurt a 50 square mile area. I was not crazy about the Steve, Diana, final words when she can't hear, and then her ability to go back and hear them clearly as a construction.
Was it her hearing it, or was it her kind of intuiting it, and we hear it?
You can't have both. You can't replay it and now she intuits what he said. I thought that was a little clunky, but this is a better end game throwdown than most. Many of them are just such garbage CGI fests with, loud crashing that there's no investment. And I was invested here and I remained with those characters. So again, I think it's a credit to the performance and to the direction.
Absolutely. And then from that, we quickly exit back to the tag scene, the bookend scene.
What was she jumping out after, though? Was that meant to be nebulous? Like, I saw Paris. I saw a riverboat. Was Joker on the riverboat? Like, was that implied? And am I just looking too hard?
Here's what I think it was meant to be. I think, and I want to stress, I don't mean this as critically as it might sound, because there's a reason why most of the comic book movies that have come prior to this one, there are certain things that are now expected, particularly in a debut film. Somebody probably said, we need to have our own thing, like at the end of the first Spider-Man. You want to know who I am? As I web through Lower Manhattan and then end up on the American flag in a movie that still has some shots of the Twin Towers, and we're able to have this triumphant New York City America moment. No, you want to know who I am? Boom, Spider-Man. You want to have a who am I? I'm Iron Man. Boom, the end. We need that. Okay, let's work back from that. How do you get that? Because is she going to be called to action? Oh no, Justice League needs your help. No, and again, let me say, loved this movie. I'm concerned that this character who I loved in this movie isn't going to be the primary. Here's what the preview for Justice League told me. Batman's going to hang out a lot with Aquaman and also recruit the Flash. And he's already hung out with Wonder Woman. And they're not going to show you any of the Superman stuff because they want to spoil that. They don't want to spoil that, rather. Anyhow, so if she's not going to go help the Justice League. What's calling her? General care for humanity? That's what I would say.
I mean, I really hope we're not seeing the best Wonder Woman movies, or Wonder Woman movies, I should say, Wonder Woman scenes from that upcoming movie. But Matt, again, that we have this blockbuster, that it's been so successful, that it's clearly going to influence movies like this going forward. I see no reason why it can't influence Justice League, that they can't say, hey, where's Gal right now? Oh, all right, she's between projects. Great. Let's get her in. You've got a guy in Whedon who can put some stuff together for a female protagonist, and maybe they amp it up on her side now with the fan favorite that this movie has made her. Let's hold on to that hope.
Let's hold on to that hope, but just want to throw out a fact here. You know how, and again, I don't mean to make this Marvel versus DC, but Pete, you know how like Sam Jackson had this 9-picture deal, and they get Tom Spider-Man. What's the new Spider-Man's name?
Tom Spider-Man. Tom Holland.
Tom Holland. He's got a 6-picture movie where it's 3 movies that he stars in and 3 movies that he appears in, in a lower, you know, a status kind of thing. You know what Gal Gadot's contract is?
I don't.
3 movies. You know when that 3rd movie comes out?
November.
Yeah. So it's like, mother of Themyscira. You didn't. Now look, maybe from the I don't know much about Hollywood contracts, and few people do. You know, some of those movies that don't make any money, like Forrest Gump, who can't pay the writer what he was supposed to be, the writer of the novel what he was supposed to be paid, because that movie lost so much money. The world of Hollywood contracts is a deep and nebulous one, but like, you're telling me you didn't lock her down for more than 3?
And well, there's already talk of a sequel here. If we don't hear in the next 2 weeks, Matt, with the legs that this film is going to have, a renegotiation or re-upping, I'd be really, really surprised.
Let's hope. Because as we start to move to our odds and ends here, the movie has a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is just, you know, well, the number stands for itself. It's on a scale of 100 is percent. But, I mean, through the roof. None of the DC stuff has reached there. Many of the Marvel movies have not gotten that high either. It's been a phenomenal critical reaction. Add to that, Pete, that breaking news, it turns out that despite the fears of some people, no male private parts have fallen off over this movie. There was nobody in our theater that was suddenly stricken a eunuch or things of that sort. So it turns out, Pete, that it's okay for men to exist in a world with a Wonder Woman film.
I don't know if they were men all along, though, Matt. I removed their man card the minute they made a beef about gender-specific screenings. You and I have never taken attendance, but have probably watched a movie of this genre in a entirely, if not almost entirely, gender-dominated environment. Stop. Get over yourselves, guys. And those who made a deal of this on social media were rightly castrated within the last week. I have rarely seen something as dumb as that. It's the old, we're back to where's White Appreciation Month, as a dumb thing that would come out of someone's mouth. Oh, well, we're going to have male-only screenings. Go ahead. I don't think anybody's going to host them. And we're not joining you.
Well, speaking of some rather bonkers reaction, the movie ultimately was banned in Lebanon because Gal Gadot is an Israeli who has served in the military. Pete, when that's our biggest problem in the world, we'll be in a much better place as a species.
Yeah, I feel bad because my grandfather, who was a cruise ship captain, his favorite port of call was in Lebanon and someplace I had hoped to go in my life, and that there are people there reacting like this because of the heritage of the actress, and she served with honor militarily, is just really, really crappy.
Last thing I want to mention, Pete, before we hear some thoughts from listeners and so forth, I thought that the music by Rupert Gregson-Williams, it was fairly good. It was above average for the genre. Nothing kind of blowing my socks off. I know he was working with the Hans Zimmer electric guitar theme. But
her theme is good. And I think they were a little over judicious in how they used it. There was a lot of what I call sonic wallpaper in this. It didn't overpower, but at the same time, it only came through maybe two examples I can think of. The one in No Man's Land, and maybe with the fight at the end. But you know, I'm somebody who's big into film scores, and you know, it's not enough of a piece. I'm hopeful in the future we can get, you know, something more on the level of the character. That Amazonian guitar riff she has, though, is pretty good.
Heading first to Twitter to see what some responses were. We ran a poll. The four choices, what did you think of the film? Four choices were loved it, liked it, it's okay, and strong gals frighten me. That
someone
last one,
answered that, right?
they did. I mean, one or two votes.
I mean, probably. Really? It's too bad we can't go back and figure out who that is.
But everybody else, there was 69% loved it, 22% liked it. So certainly a good response there. We had
nobody said it was okay, which is surprising. And then there are the two clowns who don't want gender specific viewings that, said that strong gals frighten them. So, they can be frightened of strong gals, and all you strong gals, you can come hang out with Fantastic Geek any day of the week.
Absolutely. We also heard on Twitter from Bob Keeley, who said, clearly the strongest DCEU movie. Had a tweet from ZP International, loved Wonder Woman, definitely removes the stain of Catwoman. We heard from Seren, that's at Serendipity824. This can only mean good things for Captain Marvel, which that's heads up there. Absolutely mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. Tweet from Ben Bassett, that's two S's, two T's. They nailed it this time out. More like this, please. Hashtag strong women represent. Hashtag Wonder Woman. And a tweet from Jen, that's Jen 2. I think it's two capital I's and underscore, then two more capital I's. It was amazing and so very satisfying.
Yeah, it's very hard to argue with anything that people have reacted to. In this film cruising to number one at the box office. It's going to be very interesting to see how long they can sustain it, how much they can amass. But very clearly a message has been sent that if you are going to make a quality female-led superhero movie, there is absolutely an audience for it. Here are two dudes who made time for this film, and it would have been something we would have gone to whether there was positive or negative press. So we kind of got to be there, and you know, I think we like to think that you're listening to this because you want to know what we think as people who pay attention to this stuff. But there are a whole lot of other people who are paying attention to this, particularly females, and this is so important. You know, we were kicking around last week. It's not the first female-led superhero movie. I go back to Supergirl in the 80s, which is what it is with Helen Slater. But this is a declaration. And the mention there of Captain Marvel with Brie Larson, super excited about that character, about what that's going to bring out in the Marvel universe, and just hopeful that DC can build around Wonder Woman and, you know, perhaps even some more strong female characters.
One more bit of feedback here sent via email, an email from Madeline LaRange. Only way I could describe Wonder Woman is simultaneously the best and worst superhero movie I've ever seen. The effects were like a time machine to the 2005 box office. The dialogue was either perfectly placed or cringeworthy and awkward. The storyline was skillfully done and casting was A+. I'm not mad that I watched it, but I am mad that I paid $13 for a ticket to see it. Probably the worst part was when there was 5 great minutes of female-driven superhero movie perfection, then a 30-second Baywatch-esque scene of slow motion, strutting, running with explosions in the background. Definitely could have been worse, though, and a good introduction to Wonder Woman, I'd watch it again.
Well, certainly no film is going to be above any sort of criticism. It's art. But the reception of this allows people to look at it from a variety of perspectives. And yeah, are there things there that are certainly worthy of keying in on? They are. Overall, it was about time, Matt, that DC had a critical hit. And thankfully for the characters, that we have a 77-76 year relationship with, that's finally happened.
And of course, Pete, part of this Fantastic Geek relationship is made possible by our patrons on patreon.com/fantasticgeek. They're helping us out with those podcast bandwidth and storage costs and whatnot. So I want to say a big thanks to them for being part of Team Fantastic Geek.
Absolutely. Everybody who contributes gets access to exclusive podcast content, and then you can pick yourself all sorts of perks at different levels. We're always rotating new ones in, so please check back, and we cannot thank enough of our PFans, of the greatest PFans, Matt, on the internets.
Well, Pete, how can new fans, old fans, Patreon fans, and non-Patreon fans alike be in touch with you on the Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, PieterJKetelaar, KetelaaR, 9,327 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, you can be in touch with the podcast anytime you want. We are Fantastic Geek, that is fantastic with the P and the H. You might send an email like Madeline did, fantasticgeek@gmail.com. You might visit the webpage, fantasticgeek.com. Reach out to us on Twitter or Instagram, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, apparently there's another social network.
Facebook.com/FantasticGeek with PH, all one word, like it today.
Well, Pete, the Pop Culture Podcast will be back soon, continuing with geeky goodness as we get deeper and deeper into the summer. So with that, I will say varvel to all our listeners and give you, Pete, the final word.
May we get what we want, what we need, and never what we deserve.